Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you're all having a great night out there. This is a live call-in show. If you'd like to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line, the number to call is 855-346-3351. That's 855-346-3351. I've been talking the last couple of nights about this report that came out from NASHBED on the, quote, vital role of state psychiatric hospitals. And my concerns that NASHBED, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, would be supporting any role of state hospitals, let alone calling them a vital role. I think that this is deeply problematic. And so want to continue along that line if you have any thoughts about that. I'm just getting a message here that Yvonne is trying to Skype in, and so I'm very excited about that, and I hope that that works. The number again is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, 855-346-3351. The toll-free line only works in the United States. 855-346-3351. So the vital role of state hospitals. State psychiatric hospitals. If you have anything to say, please do call in. It's interesting how backwards some of this report is. So on page 29, for example, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors confirm that the majority of persons served in state psychiatric hospitals have experienced trauma, and this trauma is often a major cause of their suffering. As such, state psychiatric hospitals should follow the draft SAMHSA guidelines for trauma-informed care, which, again, no objection to trauma-informed care. I think actually that's something that many of us have been working toward, but why does this have to happen in institutions? Why are we keeping these places open? So it says, through the input of an expert panel that included trauma survivors, SAMHSA defines trauma as the following. Quote, individual trauma rests from an event, series of events, or set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or life-threatening, and that has lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and mental, physical, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being. So that's the definition of trauma. And so they give six points that are important in developing a guiding framework for implementing trauma-informed approach. And the six key principles are, one, safety, two, trustworthiness and transparency, three, peer support services, four, collaboration and mutuality, five, empowerment, voice and choice, and six, cultural, historical and gender issues. And so I think that part of this is, so throughout safety, for example, throughout the organization, staff and the people they serve, whether children or adults, feel physically and psychologically safe the physical setting is safe, and interpersonal interactions promote a sense of safety. Understanding safety as defined by those served is a high priority. So what in what is safe about a psychiatric institution? What is safe about a place where you can be dragged down to the floor and tied down to a bed and shot up with drugs and left there? What is safe about a place of where, over your objection, you can be forced to take psychiatric drugs? What is safe about a place that can, over your objection or without your full informed consent, you can be subjected to electroshock? How, in any way, are state psychiatric institutions, quote-unquote, safe? The second thing on page 30, the second, what are they calling these, principles fundamental to a trauma-informed approach, is trustworthiness and transparency. And they explain that as organizational operations and decisions are conducted with transparency, with the goal of building and maintaining trust with clients and family members and among staff and others involved in the organization. Again, if you're not being given informed choice and informed consent and all of the information about the practices, procedures, products you are expected to comply with in psychiatric places, how are you supposed to have any trust in these places? And how are they being transparent if they're not giving you the basic information that it is that you need? Third. Peer support services. Okay, here we go again. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. What they say is that peer support services and mutual self-help are key vehicles for establishing safety and hope, building trust, enhancing collaboration, and using their stories and lived experience to promote recovery and healing. The term, quote, peers, refers to individuals with lived experience of trauma, or in the case of children, this may be family members of children who have experienced traumatic events and are key caregivers in their recovery. Peers have also been referred to as trauma survivors. So this is a whole new definition of peers. 267-521-0167, if you want to jump in on this conversation, what do you think about this? Why is this the new definition of a quote-unquote peer as a trauma survivor? Maybe this is particularly in trauma-informed care. But the idea that peer support services are going to be fundamental in the institutions, bringing people into institutions to work as opposed to outside. This was not the goal. This was not what we were supposed to be doing. Point four, collaboration and mutuality. Importance is placed on partnering and the leveling of power differences between staff and clients and among organizational staff from clerical and housekeeping personnel to professional staff to administrators, demonstrating that healing happens in relationships and in the meaningful sharing of power and decision-making. The organization recognizes that everyone has a role to play in a trauma-informed approach. And this just harkens back to John Allen's statement on page 3 of this report, where he said to those men and women who worked in housekeeping, food service, maintenance, management, clinical, and other roles, who engaged us as valuable human beings, who nurtured our sense of hope and possibility, and who helped us endure and recover, we wish to recognize your work and to thank you for your efforts, says the president of the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators, after suggesting that it may be people's sense of perceived injustice which calls for their work as in advocacy. Again, a hugely troubling, problematic that exists. Point five, empowerment, voice, and choice. I wonder if this is anything like the Choice Through Voice Project. throughout the organization and among the clients served, no, it's not, individual strengths and experience are recognized and built upon. The organization fosters a belief in the primacy of the people served, in resilience, and in the ability of individuals, organizations, and communities to heal and promote recovery from trauma. The organization understands that the experience of trauma may be a unifying aspect in the lives of those who run the organization, who provide the services, and or who come to the organization for assistance and support. As such, operations, workforce development, and services are organized to foster empowerment for staff and clients alike. Organizations understand the importance of power differentials and ways in which clients historically have been diminished in voice and choice and are often recipients of coercive treatment. Clients are supported in shared decision-making, choice, and goal-setting to determine the plan of action they need to heal and move forward. They are supported in cultivating self-advocacy skills. Staff are facilitators of recovery rather than controllers of recovery. I don't know, this is just so problematic that any of this would be seen as like, you know, if we do this to state hospitals, then they're going to be okay places and that they have a vital role inside of this. And don't forget that part of the vital role that this report cut out was that they are essential in the process of the courts. That's part of their roles is dealing with the courts. So the sixth point for the empowerment, trauma-informed, quote-unquote, hospital is cultural, historical, and gender issues. The organization actively moves past cultural stereotypes and biases, e.g. based on race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, religion, gender identity, geography, etc., and offers either directly or through referral access to gender-responsive services, leverages the healing value of traditional cultural connections, incorporates policies, protocols, and processes that are responsive to the racial, ethnic, and cultural needs of individuals served, and recognizes and addresses historical trauma. I feel like this is the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals. I'm just being asked something here online. Could you put up a link to the document you're talking about the state hospitals? Sure thing, I can, and here it comes. Just like that. There you go. Thanks for asking. There's the link. And I think people should read it, and I think people should be commenting, and I think that we should be having some kind of constructive comment aimed at NASHBED that they would suggest that we need to keep institutions open and that this is a good thing and that this is where we should be going. So I think that looking at these issues is very, very, very important. Obviously, there's another major thing that's been taking on all kinds of conversation today, and I'm still not really ready to process, but if anybody wants to call in and try that, go for it. So if you'd like to talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. On page 31, it starts with reducing seclusion and restraint, six core strategies. Now, there was clear language that we were supposed to be eliminating seclusion and restraint. So why it's gone back to a reduction model is entirely unclear to me. They said these strategies, that they list six strategies. These strategies were developed through extensive literature reviews and dialogues with experts who have successfully reduced the use of seclusion and restraints in various mental health settings for children and adults. You know, and it's leadership toward organizational change, use of data to inform practice, workforce development, you know, I wonder, I almost got fired over this when I worked at OMH for suggesting that somebody should have to spontaneously be put into restraints and seclusion prior to being able to administer it on anybody, and that was such an offensive idea to the administration of the New York State Office of Mental Health, Bureau of Children and Families, that I almost lost my job, which I guess, well, whatever, that's another whole story. Anyway, the point is that there is absolutely nothing new here, and what we know is that these, since at least the 1850s, there have been attempts to, I'm sorry, the 1830s, there have been attempts to eliminate the use of restraint and seclusion with small periods of success, and that generally what makes it successful is the administration allowing it to happen. It always amazes me that somebody would dare to say that it's necessary. You know, go to any, you know, quote-unquote peer-run program and ask them where their seclusion room is or where their restraint room is and or where they, you know, keep their restraints, and they will tell you that they don't have them, that those things are not present. So if conceivably you're dealing with the same people, either in traditional or alternative, psychiatric, whatever, why you would need restraint and seclusion in this type of place and not in in an alternative peer-run place is, well, you know, one of the main reasons is because the people who are at alternative or peer-run places are generally there on a completely voluntary basis. They want to be there so that nobody needs to shoot them up with drugs and lock them up in a room and tie them down to a bed to keep them there. And, you know, so these are big issues that we need to be addressing. Area code 267-521-0167, if you'd like to call in, 267-521-0167. I'd also like to remind everybody that on Thursday night, August 14th, that I will be joined by lawyer and survivor activist Tina Minkowitz to talk about human rights. Tina is a leading voice internationally for the rights of users and survivors of psychiatry and has been influential in creating revolutionary new standards in international law. What are human rights and what is a human rights convention are some of the questions that we're going to be grappling with. In addition to what is the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, and why is it important for people who have been psychiatrized, what is shadow reporting, which I'm really excited about having a conversation about shadow reporting and trying to figure out how can we use human rights advocacy to end psychiatric oppression. For those of you who don't know Tina Minkowitz, she was one of the drafters of the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, and has contributed extensively to the development of norms related to legal capacity, the freedom from disability-based detention, and the freedom from forced psychiatric interventions as a form of torture and ill treatment. She is the international representative of the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and the founder and president of the Center for the Human Rights of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, which I guess I should mention I am on the board of directors of. And so I'm just so excited about this, and there is a Facebook event page that has been established already. There's people signing up to go in. We will have open lines that night also, so if you have questions for Tina, you will be able to call in. So I look forward to that. That's going to be Thursday night from 9 to 11 p.m. And so, Iman, I know that you've been trying to get through, and I know you're in Geneva. I hope that you will be able to get in and give us a report about how it's going and what is happening. out there on in your attendance at the United Nations on the Convention on the Elimination of All Racial Discrimination, all forms of racial discrimination. And so I'm very interested to see. I know that there was a video that you have put up, and so, hi, I see your text, and I hope that you'll be able to get in also. 267-521-0167, if you'd like to call in. I know that Blog Talk Radio had a crash this morning, and so perhaps that might be some of what it is that people are experiencing problematically if you are having a problem. I also know that there's been a big buzz all over concerning Robin Williams' death, I don't want to talk about this. I really feel like this is, if this was, what I do want to talk about, though, is that the official press release of the Marin County Sheriff's Office and the Coroner's Division, in their prepared statement, that this is still very much under investigation. This is what they are assuming, that Robin Williams completed suicide, but there is absolutely no final determination made on that. And there are still toxicology reports that need to be done, and there is an active investigation. And so the way that the media and what I've heard on other talk radio shows throughout the day and over the last, 24 hours or so is frighteningly disturbing of how everybody is just going to this rampage of if only psychiatry was available, we need to make psychiatry more available, and that this is not necessarily the answer. But it is one of these high-profile situations that will that may lead the march in order to push things forward. And so if you look at just a Google search of suicide, which I do believe is a highly personal kind of thing in the news, you just get an onslaught of different news agencies that are now addressing suicide and people talking about that we should be talking about suicide. So including Time, USA Today, NBC News, it really is almost disturbing to see how many different news agencies are jumping on this. If you'd like to call in or talk, and if you're having trouble getting through, like Yvonne and others have reported, I'm guessing that Blog Talk Radio is having a little issue still after its crash. But keep trying. The number is 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, 855-346-3351. So in the, the way that this follows, the way that it's just getting played out in society, in our pop culture, is really, to me it's just so troubling, and that we don't know anything, we don't have any way of of being able to contend with this in the way it is, and it's troubling. And so for people who have been upset by this, people who have been trying to process it, and all of the stereotypes and discrimination that is getting played out in the media, that can also be damaging. But then I've seen, you know, some of these, you know, quote-unquote consumer groups or people who support, you know, psychiatry, is that, you know, that this is an inevitable part of having a quote-unquote diagnosis of depression. This is that suicide is just a symptom, and that it's the outcome of the illness. And so this is also very, very, very troubling, and that, again, the calls for genetic potential components or any of this kind of thing is just, I don't know, it just really, really deeply troubles me that this is where our society is at. And I kind of really wish the lines were open. 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. Yeah. So, let's see, just out of curiosity, does the NASHBID report doesn't actually use the word suicide. Danger to self doesn't be used any either. So I'm not sure where the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals fall inside of all of this, but it is a deep problematic. Let's see. There's also there's a reminder to talk with your elected representatives about the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, and to express your opposition to it or any other potential bills that come forward that are similar to it, to make sure that your representatives know how you feel in general about mental health law, why we even need laws like this is so troubling. Let's see. I think there may be there is a call on the line. Hi, your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Yvonne, you got through.
Yeah, I'm calling from Geneva, Switzerland.
Geneva, Switzerland.
Yeah,
How are you? There's a little bit of a reverb on the computer, but if you're using your computer to Skype in, that may just happen. So, we'll push through it.
I'll try to talk slowly.
Okay, how's it going?
Oh, it's going pretty well. I don't know how much your callers know, but I'm at the United Nations Eliminating Racial Discrimination meeting. And, of course, psychiatry and mental health abuse has been brought up many times. There are several subcommittees, and at least four of them have brought up that issue. And we presented today the various subcommittees. I'm on the health committee, and there are other committees, committees on state violence, committees on the criminal justice system, and people put forth a very good case about discrimination, discriminating use of psychiatry as a form of violence against African-American people. So that was what happened today. I'm not going to stay on too long. It's kind of late here. I got on late trying to figure out Skype because I've been having problems trying to use my cell phone here. But as I promised you, I was going to try to call you a couple of times from Geneva. But so far, that's what's happened. The Human Rights Network is a wonderful organization. I just love being a part where there's 100 people together and you honor everyone's issues and you are sort of on the same page. So it's a wonderful experience. It has been some long nights because talking to the committee, they make you be very precise, like 2 minutes, 4 minutes, for various issues. And you can imagine if you have your subcommittee of advocates, human rights advocates, that might be 8 or 9, you think, well, how are you going to get 8 or 9 people to agree on a 2-minute soundbite and cover all of our issues, or 4 minutes? It's been a very interesting experience, and I just looking forward to tomorrow and see what looking come and see what the government has to say. There was a private consultation very late today. I think that was more so that the government can kind of prepare. But if we're having a lot of vibration, I think that I can work on this. So maybe by Wednesday or Thursday, it might be a little better.
Well, how very exciting, and I'm so glad that you called in from Geneva at the United Nations, the work of the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The world is literally benefiting from you being there. And so thank you so much for your work.
And Lauren, on my Facebook page, and you can go up and share in your page, I have a clip of the health committee, Monica Simpson's presentation this morning, so people can see it. But as I said, I don't want the sound quality to be too poor. I want to make sure that you have a good show. And perhaps I will call back at least one more time while I hear, probably twice. I see that Tina is going to be on your show Thursday.
Yeah, she's going to be on the show Thursday night. I'm sharing this clip right now. And I don't know if you heard last night, but Anthony called in that he is free and clear and won his battle against being under involuntary outpatient commitment in New York. And he won. Yeah. That was a great piece of information and great congratulations out. And we're going to be doing a special sometime in the future about strategies for court and for doing that also. But yeah, Tina being on Thursday night from 9 to 11 is going to be just great. And I look forward to when you get back and to be able to talk in depth about what happened and all that.
Well, Tina has been closely monitoring what's been going on here. And so we've been in very close communication. So she knows a lot about what's been going on. I mean, there's just, you know, a lot of advocates all around that are here on human rights. And there are certain things that I just really didn't know were still going on in this country. And I just have to say, the USA, I mean, the human rights violations are just up the kazoo. I didn't know that we had forced sterilization still going on.
In the United States.
We may have to have a long talk or whatever, but I'm just saying that a lot of the abuses that we would think on all counts, not just mental health and violation of people's bodies, well, that's a violation of the body that are going on, that I guess as an African-American person, I'm just sometimes inundated with racism or gotten to be kind of like just above, below the surface. But a lot of these things that even though they affect African-Americans, they affect everyone, just like the abuses around psychiatry. It's just that it's sometimes much easier to do it, to marginalize groups, but they are injustice to one is injustice to all. And even some of the things that are happening in the Indian nations and other places. I'm going to sign off now and try to hit the sack because we've been, have to get ready for tonight. Had to send some things to counterparts on another committee because we want to try to see if other friendly parties or members of the CERT will ask questions of the government. And maybe Tina or I will explain to this exactly the process. It's very controlled. So, and I said, you know, you have a finite window. We can't really ask questions ourselves. Members of the CERT ask questions, and CERT stands for Committee to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, but it's very interesting process, and even how you talk to the various delegates there. I had lunch with one of the delegates, and the person spoke another language, and I was able to use technology to have a conversation with this person for at least a half an hour.
Wow.
Like so, you know, but I'm learning on my feet. You know, you just have to do what you have to do. And like I said, I have a great group of people here from all over the United States pressing at me. The government has flown in a lot of their people. I mean, we're really putting fire up under their butt. I mean, the U.S. Human Rights Network, if people don't know about it, they should find out more about it. And I'll probably post a hashtag on your Facebook page so that other people can find out more information about this wonderful organization that is still fighting human rights. As I said, there are a lot of things that I hadn't sampled. I thought that sterilization, I remember it as a child, but I thought that stuff had ended in 1974. So we have a lot of battles to go to continue. And people tell you that your things aren't happening. They are. They are still happening. Good night, Lauren.
Well, thank you so much, Yvonne, and have a good night, and I look forward to an update. Safe travels, and I hope every moment of questioning our government serves us all well. So I look forward
to I'm going to try to listen back tomorrow evening and see if I can work on the quality of the voice.
Okay.
I'm going to try to figure out. I can't get my phone off airplane mode, and I'm having some trouble. But I will try to see if I want your calls to have a good quality conversation. I'll try to post as much stuff as I can to Facebook and Twitter and try to call you back.
Great. Thanks so much,
good
Iman.
Night.
Good night. Talk with you soon. Fabulous. Oh, wow. This is just amazing. From Geneva, Iman calls in and gives an update on her work at the United Nations meetings on the Convention Against Elimination, Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. And so I'm really going to be very interested to learn about what other information Iman was able to gather and what this is about the still forced sterilization in the United States, and learning ever more where those things are. So I think that it's going to be really very interesting to see where things go in the future, and how we move along inside of these things. This is where we're at. So again, if you'd like to call in, the number to call is 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. So I'm not sure where to go at this point, but I know for a fact that people are being abused and tortured, murdered, and held in servitude, slavery, at the hands of psychiatry. And there are many people who are pushing this forward, using anything they can to advance the agenda of forced psychiatry, and that this remains a real problem, I think. And so I do believe that we need to speak out and organize and find ways to better our society, and not just fall victim to what it is they are currently pushing out in terms of it just seems to be such a problematic thing to me that we're not moving any forward at all on any level, that there's just this thing. And then, you know, then on August 7th, there was this article, blog, put out by Mary Jill Birdie, the NAMI executive director, about the Barber and Murphy bills. And it's, you know, a total, I don't know, maybe you want to go read it. It's called Setting the Record Straight. You know, complaining that as Congress, this is the opening sentence, as Congress goes into its August recess, it is yet to act on legislative proposals to improve mental health care in the U.S. Nearly 2 years after the Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, focused attention on the nation's broken mental health system, there has been much discussion in Congress about how to improve mental health care, but very little resolution. Two significant bills have been introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives, one by Representative Tim Murphy, Republican, Pennsylvania, the other by Congressman Ron Barber, Democrat, Arizona. Both bills contain many excellent provisions that, if enacted, would represent major improvements in mental health system. So this is like the Mental Health America, hailing the Barber and Murphy bills, and that there are ways that there is something that is going on that can be good. You remember the Barber bill, while different than the Murphy bill and has different issues in it, the Barber bill is just as bad in some ways, because what it's focusing on is early intervention and prevention and treatment of young people, young adults, and veterans. Area code 484, your line is open.
Yes, hi, my name is Raymond.
Hi, Raymond.
I wanted to follow up. I was listening earlier, and you had talked about the use of forced medication on people.
Yes.
On the term, right? Having had some experience with that myself, and experience in a state hospital, that this the terminology of that has always bothered me, because the truth of the matter is, the medication they use when the situation warrants force, quote unquote, it's called chemical restraints.
Yes,
okay.
I usually call it forced drugging. I don't usually call it forced medication. So,
okay, right. But interesting enough, so I having my own experience with that type of medication, I looked it up. Basically, olanzapine, Haldol, Zyprexin. Those are the three, there's more of them, medications or drugs that they use. And it's really primarily to sedate people. It's not to treat a psychosis.
Very much
agree. Right, and I really think that if we start, because I've started doing it myself when I'm talking to people about this, to be knowledgeable about just what happens and what the procedures are for their use. And I just found this website. I didn't want to put it up, post it, because I wasn't quite sure of how triggering it would be. But it's called gelmedicine.com. And believe it or not, it gives you step-by-step just what involuntary chemical sedation is.
Jailmedicine.com.
I could post it on here. Yeah. And this will actually tell you when you're explaining it to people, because once any sane person reads this, they'll just, it's horrifying. Just how easy chemical sedation is. And it doesn't really solve the, quote, psychosis at all. And now, of course, this is what they use in jails and prisons. And it's probably a whole lot cheaper than with providing them with any other type of medication.
Right. And this, absolutely. And chemical restraint, you know, it's interesting, because I just did a quick, search inside of the vital role, crap report out of NASHBED, and chemical restraint isn't mentioned, but I know that they're aware of it. of chemical restraint, and because this has been a consistent issue. Did you post the link, Raymond? Because I'm not seeing it.
On the Facebook page. I thought I did.
I'll try to find it because I think that this is the exact kind of thing that people need to be made aware of, that this is what's happening, and it is about control and sedation and stopping a situation. It is not about assistance, which is why if I did say psychiatric medication before, unless maybe I was reading it, generally I use the term psychiatric drugging. This is even further than that, that this is a chemical restraint, that this is a way of hampering somebody's ability to object or even move.
In fact, what it says is generally within an hour, the person will be asleep if it was done correctly. And with the follow-up, it says down the bottom, you basically... preferably within 24 hours is when you decide to investigate why the person was agitated to begin with, which is kind of hilarious. I'm like, don't try to find out why. Just sedate them.
It's a major problem. It really is just another example of how the government is allowing this fraud of psychiatry to be perpetuated across all groups of people and in all places. I still am not seeing that website though, and I would be interested in in checking it out. So if you can. I don't know if you can post it on my page or...
Maybe I'll do it. That work, if I post it on the Blog Talk Radio page?
It might, but I just won't be able to see it until I'm off the air. But yeah, okay. So I'll go look at it afterwards.
Or maybe.
Yeah.
Hold on. Can I do a message? Hold on. All right. Hold on. I just think it is important that we be able to answer, because people write these documents really haven't, I don't really believe they have any experience whatsoever of actually being in restraints, witness someone being in restraints, or having any experience visiting someone in a state hospital.
No, and I think that's one of the biggest problems, even with this research, or the idea of, a genetic component to suicide or any, like these people clearly don't understand what this experience is, because if they did, this is not the way that they would be going about even asking the questions. They don't even ask the right questions. And to think that, outside of the convenience of staff, like, why do we need to be sedated, right? Why do we need to be under control? If people were not involuntarily being held, then, 99% of the problems would probably be eliminated, right? Obviously, the difference between jail psychiatry and psychiatry outside of a jail or prison is going to be somewhat different, right? The human rights violations are the same, but it's not different because those who are institutionalized are like prisoners, unable to voluntarily leave.
Right. Yeah.
And so the issue is the same, and since they do it the same in both prisons and psychiatric institutions, it's just so troublesome because I think if the average person was aware of what was really happening in these places, that there might not be as much public support for what psychiatry is doing. A great, huge taxpayer expenditure. I mean, just out of control, the amount of money that spending on this.
Well, hey, and the other thing was I just started looking up, doing a fact check on the web regarding what kind of drug information they have on the different websites. And I looked up Haldol because I know from my personal experience that's the go-to meds that people, that staff use for chemical restraints. And so I went online to this medicinenet.com, and I have to tell you this. It says, this medicine will help you to think more clearly, feel less nervous, and take part in everyday life. Can also help treat uncontrolled movements.
Unbelievable.
And I'm like, what? First of all, Haldol is a sedative. When I took it, when they gave it to me, okay, I was sedated. So, of course, I felt less nervous. I didn't think clearly. And as far as uncontrolled movements, first of all, they also had me take Benadryl. Now, supposedly, that was because of the side effects of the Haldol with involuntary movements. So, again, I was just like, what? I thought I remember hearing that it's called the Haldol Shuffle.
Right, or the Thorazine Shuffle. Right, absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
These are heavy, heavy, heavy psychotropic drugs that are so damaging, that have so many side effects, tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome. I mean, that really cause damage to the body and are not, and they're prescribed so lightly. They're just, as if they have some kind of real evidence of being effective or efficient in any way. And the idea that they're using it just as a control and sedation, in chemical restraint, is a real, yeah.
Well, I always thought that the issue with TAC and DJ Daffy and all that kind of stuff was, one, it was fear-mongering, and two, if you really look at it, they're talking about perpetuating the issue regarding public safety. It's like either it's public safety trumps everything. So as far as what they've been trying to push.
And it's a scam. It's a scam. I mean, if somebody is doing something criminal, then legitimately criminal, and what is criminal needs to be really looked at. When you see that, like, so many of these people who are locked up in, like, Cook County Jail, for example, where the warden is saying that, you know, oh, yeah, sure, they're all criminal, but, like, the majority of them are there for trespassing because they're trying to find some place to sleep, or petty theft because they're trying to get something to eat, you know, like, that's, so dangerous criminal is different than just, you know, quote-unquote criminal, and people confuse all that.
Right.
But, if there's something criminal, we have a very deeply problematic criminal system, prison industrial complex that needs to be dealt with on a whole other level. But the idea that psychiatry is taking responsibility for criminality, or saying that they are somehow going to be able to stop this, or that they can, you know, quote unquote, predict who needs to be locked up or have this kind of, you know, it's such a fraud. And because the average person, you know, wants to be safe and both trusts in government and trusts in doctors and the authority that comes with all that, they just, you know, are blindly following along and saying, yeah, sure, here, how many more million dollars do you need every year? Like, this is...
Right. And... let's see. I downloaded a document. You had talked. I mentioned about regarding peer specialists or having peers work within the hospital setting.
Yes.
And unfortunately, as someone who works as a peer specialist, I had a very good friend who worked at a state hospital, I only imagine the stress he had been under for working there, as being the primarily outside peer specialist with all these ideas about what he could do or what he wanted to do, and being the only one. I think it was maybe him and maybe one other person. I always kind of say that it kind of, doing this job, I kind of get reminded like I'm the canary in the mine, basically. We're the ones that are going to be the first people that witness or experience what the real issues are with the environment. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't pay attention. And we drop. Because we don't know who to talk to, who to gain any support from, and we find ourselves in positions where, for our own safety or for our own health, it's not a place to be.
So you're on the front lines. You're in the midst of it, and every day you're going in there and trying to do what you can.
Yeah, right. I certainly am not one to regarding if there are issues with meds. I support the person. I try to advocate help with the person, find out, believe it or not, what medications are they on, and to learn about. And believe it or not, sometimes we've gotten into major issues with the professionals about that. Like, of course he needs to know. Why doesn't he? Why shouldn't I tell him what medications he's on and what the side effects are?
Wait, there's dispute about whether or not some individual would be told what medication they were on?
Or we have done this, I don't know why we need to tell you, or that's confidential. Why can't you ask the person what meds he's on? Which is kind of ridiculous because if we could ask the person, we would. We did. Obviously, the person doesn't know what meds he's on.
That's such a problem in itself. Yeah, I mean, because everybody should be. Yeah.
So I go from week to week, personally, the person. Either a nurse or a caseworker, case manager, for not being very helpful to me at all. Actually, it's been 3 weeks running. Case managers are on the top of my hit list. So as far as trying to complicate what I do with the person, what I'm able to do, or what the person wants to do with me. I hope you were able to get that information about the gel medicine.
Yes, I did see the link, and I'm looking at it, and even like the way that they're talking about I agree with you. I don't see how somebody, after reading this, can think that any of this is okay. And the fact that this is so easily, these subjective standards of danger to self or others as a legitimacy for this, and then when you see that when you look at the numbers, I remember when I worked at the New York State Office of Mental Health, one of the things that was clear that it seemed to be the same inmates who were getting restrained and secluded and chemically restrained, and the same staff members were consistently
right.
involved. And so
right.
why isn't there a concentrated effort across the board to it's not about training staff. It's about getting staff who are continually involved with these kinds of violent incidents against people who are supposedly in need of quote-unquote help out of this profession. That they should, you know, because there are plenty of staff members who have never been involved in a restraint or seclusion episode, who have never had, you know, somebody spit on them or any of these other things that they wind up using as grounds for being able to do what they want. And so
right.
why are the people who are supposedly, you know, being given some level of authority or power, why is there not a clear investigation into these people? And
right.
that the rule is that if you get into an incident with somebody of restraint or seclusion, that you're immediately suspended during an investigation and termination is likely. How quickly would things change if people knew they were going to get fired if they were involved in a restraint or seclusion episode? And
right.
that this is, you know, and just forced treatment in general. I mean, I remember the days of, geez, I'm blanking on her name. I don't want to say the wrong name, but where forced treatment was a systems failure.
Right.
You know. That this was and nobody's taking responsibility for it. And then the people who are working in these, you know, quote unquote peer roles, have their hands tied, and really can't do anything, and are really you know, very often lied to about what it is that they're there, and even in the training doesn't really ever talk about what the original
right.
goals were, was to get people out, not to convince people to, like, take their meds and stuff, and various state to state. But, you know, if you're in a position as a quote-unquote peer where you're not allowed to report that you don't take drugs, how,
right.
how you know what I mean? How,
right.
how is that going to get to other people? And I think that we're just missing the boat on these things. And in the meantime, you know, nobody pays attention to the fact that, like, lobotomy is still occurring. They just call it neurosurgery. That electroshock is still going on, even over people's expressed objection. And that these drugs are modernized versions of lobotomy and electroshock. They are designed to stop people, to destroy the brain, to make people incompetent. And
mm-hmm.
that they are successful. These drugs are successful in doing that. And again, if somebody with informed consent and choice wants to take these, you know, take whatever drugs you want, I don't, that's not my business. But where it comes to a point to where people aren't being given information, they're not being told even what drug they're on. If you're being handed all of these pills every day, and you don't know which pill is what and what they're doing, and some of the side effects are so insidious, and some of the side effects are so embarrassing that people may not even feel comfortable to report that this is what's happening to them, and they can be experiencing toxic effects. I mean, since Bragan's toxic psychiatry, what was that, 91 or 89 or something like that? I mean, they mm-hmm. have known about this for decades and decades. And it just... I think it puts us in such a position of where we're already an oppressed group of people who are trying to make a change in the system any way that we can, with absolutely, like, no real power base to fight against the conglomerates of the psychiatric industries and the state-sponsored institutions that with huge
right.
state power, you know, and so,
well,
yeah.
I was going to say the other thing that's scary is that, now things are going, the Rikers prisons, Cook County, Los Angeles, where, that's the largest place where instead of going to state hospitals, people are going there. And what's scary is there's nothing in place there about oversight. You don't, there's no access for advocates or for peer specialists. Once the person's in prison, you're up to the warden, whether they'll allow you to come in or not. I've attempted to participate and do a support group. But I've done it twice. And there's been issues both times. So, which is interesting because, one end they talk about wanting forensic peer specialists to be involved, and yet they don't, I guess they really don't want forensic peer specialists. Okay.
No, they don't want any of this. I think that's part of the problem is that then people wind up, say you had the best training in the world, say it was the most authentic, it really did like the core values of the liberation movement, it did everything that like the people in the 70s would have wanted to see somebody have information access to, plus with every updated piece of information about all of the damage that psychiatry does and everything, right? Say it's the best peer specialist training that anybody could ever imagine, which I'm not sure exists. But then you get into this traditional institution that just sees you as, barely a step up from the quote-unquote mental patients that you're there to try to help get out.
Right.
And you're not given any kind of respect or autonomy. There are either unwritten and in some cases written rules that people who aren't out about their psychiatric history and aren't working in peer roles or, offices of consumer or recipient affairs or whatever, are not allowed to socialize with people who are in peer roles. So you have two employees, both being paid by the same employing entity, and yet they are not allowed to have a social relationship because one has an identified psychiatric history and one doesn't. The levels of discrimination, I really don't think that people understand what it's like going in this and being that outed person where now somehow you're less than everybody else because you're outspoken about this assignment that you've been given at some point in your life.
Right, yeah. I was thinking about doing a workshop about, I called it implicit versus explicit roles. I wanted to do it as someone who's gone through the system, but as even for my peers that I work with, because there are these, there are the rules that are written up on the wall, right? And then there are all these hidden implied rules, that you fully learn about until you've been in the program for a while. And generally these are the rules that get you in trouble the most, or the unwritten ones, and that's, I spend a lot of my time trying to help people navigate that. I spend a lot of my time trying to navigate it myself,
Do you have any suggestions for people who are also in the belly of the beast on a daily basis trying to work their way through these kinds of things?
I guess the biggest thing is deal with the feeling uncomfortable. you know, it's part of the job, feeling uncomfortable, not knowing quite literally what to do next. But, you know, having one of my values that I keep with is, you know, do no harm, right? Make sure that, and mainly focus on the person I'm working with. You know, if I piss off the staff person or the nurse, okay, then I'm sorry, you know.
I mean the power structure, like one of the things that the vital role of state hospitals crap talked about was the power structure inside of this, and that in a trauma-informed situation that the power imbalance is leveled. And that doesn't exist. But I don't think the average person really understands how belittling it is to be in one of these roles and how the different people in different power levels interact. So the difference,
right,
for example, of a nurse, a mental health frontline worker versus a nurse versus a psychologist versus a psychiatrist, and the very many interactions and levels of, relationship between a quote-unquote peer worker and a psychiatrist, or, you know, how is that power balance getting leveled out?
Generally it's really hard to do that because we're never in the same meetings.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we're not. So we don't know. And of course, it annoys people because we're always asking them questions. You know, and so kind of like, don't you know? I'm like, no, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. You know, I don't know why. I kind of thought it was a no-brainer, actually, that came up. I was visiting someone today, and lo and behold, the comment was that they think the lithium is affecting his thyroid.
They think.
And I'm like, yeah, and I'm kind of like, okay, well, how long did it take you to figure that one out? You know?
It really, it's so troublesome because they just, it's almost like they don't, if you go back to like even Goffman, that they just see us as objects that need to be worked on and to not
right.
have these kinds of things. I mean, there's so much clear evidence about thyroid disease and connection to lithium to even suggest
right.
that, you know, we think it is. I mean, that this is not like
right.
a new breakthrough in coming out about information that, lithium affects the thyroid. It's
yeah.
one of the main risks. Thyroid, kidney, uh-huh. and weight gain problems is
right.
All related to, and along with kidney and I said
right.
kidney, sorry. These are...
Yes, and lastly, one of my pet peeves is HIPAA, okay? As part of the program I'm in, I have everybody sign releases, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I discovered, believe it or not, they're not worth the paper they're printed on. I don't even know why we have them sign them. Because I can't tell you how many times I've gone somewhere only to find out that the person's not there and that the person's was sent to a hospital. And I have to find out what hospital the person was sent. Was sent on Friday and today's Tuesday and no one told me. So I have to go find, drive, to find out what hospital he got admitted to. Because no one felt the need that they needed to tell us. Tell my program where the person got sent to. Because we weren't their case manager or their primary person, as I was told. Anyway, so
even if you're listed by that person as somebody who they want to have contacted, yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at the like even the Marin County Sheriff's Office, Coroner Division, the press conference statement that was supposedly read today. But they specifically said HIPAA in that press conference, and it's not in the statement. But any time that the government wants to hide behind having to own up to what it is it actually is doing to people, they pull out HIPAA. HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Privacy Accountability Act, does not protect us individuals. It protects the government and the institutions.
Right.
They don't care about our privacy. And the only time it ever comes up is, like, when you need that. And I remember even trying to find some of the archival materials and get some of the records from the 1850s because I wanted to look at what Phoebe Davis from 1855 was saying compared about her experiences at the Utica State Lunatic Asylum compared to what her medical records said. And there used to be a 75-year... hold on any medical records that after that they could be released. And so when I went to try to get them, they then said, no, we have to hide behind HIPAA. And because of HIPAA, you can't see her records. And it's like, well, she wrote about it. You know, she was very, very clear, and she published many books, two books, you know, about her experiences at this place. Why can't we see? So even from 150 years ago, it's still too recent to have the system be put under any kind of investigation, and that they're just not interested in protecting our rights on any level.
Well, for me personally, my first experience with this was being sent to the state hospital, hospitalized on a Friday. No, actually, it was a week. It was a holiday. It was Thursday, okay? And for that whole 4 days, okay, I was in a black hole because I couldn't call my parents, okay, because I didn't have any money to call them, okay? and they kept calling in to talk to me, but because there were no release forms signed because I didn't see a social worker until that Monday, no one could tell them that I was there at the hospital. Okay? And
even in prison, you get a call, right? Like,
yeah, it's like, wait a minute, what do you mean? They can't tell you. They don't. I was just flabbergasted about that. I was like, well, yeah, of course. Well, the other thing was I didn't even know they called in because I wasn't told anything. So I was made to feel like no one cared that I was down in the hospital. So, that was my first experience with HIPAA. So, and second, doesn't HIPAA stop if the person is dead? I know this is kind of more morose, but, you know, quite literally, there is no HIPAA. The person is deceased. What's there to protect?
And the only thing to protect is their interests, the state's interest. And to be able to, I mean, and further, the lack of ability, the way that they prevent any kind of ability to confirm what was written, to be able to tell that story, and to be able to have that kind of thing, that it's just not available. It's, you know, and then people trying to get their records. One of the things that came out of HIPAA was that people can get their medical records. And yet there's still all these problems that people have run into, and Deb Schwarzkopf has been phenomenal at ectjustice.com about educating people about how
right,
to do that.
Right.
But I, you know, but still, the average person doesn't know
yep.
or think that there even needs to be a reason of why they should check their records, you know, because people believe that doctors are trained to keep records well and to not and to represent things honestly and truthfully and to, you know, but very often when people describe what their experience of reading their records is like, it's like, who the hell
right.
are these people talking about? Like, this doesn't describe
yeah.
me on any level. And so the institution is interested in protecting the institution.
Right. Exactly. Right, right. I was working for the HCC once, and I was doing the National Self-Help Clearinghouse training, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was a thing regarding about your records, and I gave them that spiel that you're allowed to ask. Well, I was given the third degree by the program director about that, because, of course, people after my class came and started asking about their records.
Okay.
So, and I had this bright idea to actually let people see what a real record looks like. It was a mock chart. It had all the paperwork that you normally see in someone's chart. But they were all blank, because I wanted people to know what it was that they needed to ask for. It's kind of that catch-22, because
uh-huh.
the rules are that you need to tell them exactly what it is that you want to look for. But if you've never seen the charts or your own records, you don't know what it is that you need to ask for. Okay?
Right.
So,
that's
oh
right.
boy. Yeah, exactly. So I asked the front desk, and they looked at me like I had a third head. They quite literally would refuse to help me out. So I was actually worked at the regional office, so I just went to a different site and got all the paperwork and put it all together because they wouldn't give me a blank chart, and they certainly wouldn't allow me to look at someone else's chart. Okay. So they weren't going to help me out at all. So I said, forget this. And I explained it to my supervisor, who thought it was a great idea at the time. Besides, he wanted me out of his hair. So, but, yeah. Again, they were talking about HIPAA and stuff. And I'm like, HIPAA implies for real records, not for blank charts. You know?
Right.
But this is how difficult people will make things for you as a peer specialist. And if you're not willing to deal with that, it's really going to affect how you're able to do your job. So, you know.
I think that's the real sad thing about it, is that people are limited by the support that they have around them in the institution. And if the institution doesn't want you there, or the people that you're interacting with don't see you as legitimate, then your ability to do work is seriously limited by that. That you have only as much access as you're given. It really is like the definition of a child. Like a child has only as many rights as the parent will allow them, right?
Right.
So, as a quote unquote peer worker, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that we're up against is like, can you challenge the larger psychiatric domain inside of it? Can you challenge forced treatment as a peer? And yesterday, Joe Rogers called in and said that people who work for him can. But I know many people who would get fired on the spot and who have gotten fired for challenging for psychiatry or the notion of psychiatry as legitimate in the first place. And so I'm just wondering where you're at. Is there a rule of thumb about that or unspoken rule?
Well, one, the interesting thing is that we've been sort of removed from those type of meetings. I don't know whether that's just so that doesn't conflict or get in the way of what we do with when we're working with people.
Mm-hmm.
I do see it does have its advantages. Like when I'm with someone or I go out to see them or start working with them, they know that I have nothing to do with medications, with house rules, with their psychiatrists, or their money, which is another big thing. Power struggle. It's all about power struggles and issues. And, the biggest way to get hurt that I found with working in this environment, in this system, is being involved with someone else's money. That would certainly get people upset with you. Okay?
Right.
As a repayee.
Okay.
And I'm not one of them, so thank God. Yeah, one of the things I do is like, look, I don't want to be involved with medications, taking medications to people. And I also don't want to be involved in that structure with being involved with taking money out to people because, quote, they're not capable of taking care of their own money.
Are those things that people who are in peer roles where you're at are involved in?
I've seen other staff being involved with that, I could say. Not as a peer specialist role, no. But someone who's, say, working at a residential program as staff or working as an assistant to a case management team may be required, oh, can you take so-and-so's medication out to them? Okay? Which kind of sounds innocent, but then you get there and you realize, the person's you show them up at their door with the medication in hand and they may not want it.
Right.
Then what are you going to do with it?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Bringing the final bullet home. And I think that this is part of it. I know that there are people who have called in talking about their role in trying to convince people to take their drugs or other things like that, and that's not what we're doing, and that's one of the fears about this Medicaid billable stuff and the certification process of how far away it is from the original intent of getting people out, getting people free.
Mm-hmm. Well, before the night ends, I think the other push that I got to see recently is now they are trying to change again the structure so that, we'll call you recovery coaches instead. We won't
recovery
call you peer coach. We'll call you recovery coaches, which, unfortunately, in some of the other locations, areas in my state, recovery coaches used to be called case managers, right?
Right.
So, and then it's we're doing case management work, and we're doing it cheaper.
Right.
Okay.
And that's not the work. I mean, and that, those are the exact fears that we have in New York, that as this stuff comes in, and it comes in that even more than already, that people are going to be just, quote-unquote junior case managers running around, you know, insisting people go to appointments and, you know, showing up at people's houses and checking up on them and convincing them to participate in psychiatry.
Right.
And that if they step out of line, that if they challenge psychiatry in their own life, if they refuse to, maybe they decide that they don't want to take drugs anymore or whatever, that not only is their livelihood at stake, but the potential for being reinstitutionalized and forcibly drugged is much greater than if the person had really gotten out of the system and not then worked for it upon, you know, discharge.
Well, yeah, my caveat to that is I don't mind taking people to doctor's appointments. I think a lot of people are like, we have issues with that. If the person asks you to go and you're there to support them and they benefit by you being there, I don't find that as a problem at all. It's the other way around where people show up and say, well, you have a doctor's appointment today and you're going, you know. That's the kind of stuff I don't like. Or that's the kind of stuff that puts people in harm's way. So,
right, well, that voluntary versus involuntary or coercive kind of factor. And to call somebody a peer, I mean, I guess if minimally, if they're not calling you a peer anymore, then it's not got the illusion that you've got some kind of, you know, unambiguous power equality amongst you. You know, and if you're a coach, I guess there's some level of power that you would have over a person implied in the name. So at least, it's bull. I mean, it shouldn't be happening. It just people who have a lived experience should be able to, on a mutual level, exchange and support others who are going through it. But in no way should there be this ability for state to step in and say that you have to now coerce this person into this.
Yeah. I can honestly say that I've only been able to survive and gone through all this really is because of the support of my family. My brother, my parents, and I rely on them for my support system. You don't want to, I guess my one advice is work on creating a good support system that's not part of the job. You know, don't rely on your supervisor as your support person or your therapist, quote, unquote, okay, because they're not. And unfortunately, you know, it's good to have working relationships with your coworkers, but it's the same thing with them too. The job is very ambiguous. That's for certain. And I know that I will be triggered. I know that. Part of my job. It's part of my not dangers of the job. Just something I now expect. I don't call them triggers anymore. It's just issues of being uncomfortable, uncomfortable moments. I call them. So, because they will happen. Anyway.
Raymond, I thank you for calling in and for sharing all this because I do think it's important that people are made aware of it. And if the people who are, the only way that people are going to find out is that the people who are doing it are calling up and talking about what these experiences are really like and ways to protect yourself in those positions and to try to protect the integrity of what you are there to do in the first place. And I know that that's a daily battle that people are taking on. And so,
So next time someone talks to me about medication that they use, that forced medication, I'll know more. I'll be able to correct them and say it's forced drugging is what it is.
Yeah.
So
it sure is, and we need, and it's rampant, and it's in communities, it's in institutions, it's in jails and prisons, it's in schools, in nursing homes, it's happening everywhere. And anyone is potentially subject to it, and I think that's the other thing that people just really think that they are somehow separate from this. People who haven't been involved with psychiatry or, you know, who don't know about the system, they think that somehow it's some other group of people that's being talked about that they can never be part of. I think what we're going to wind up seeing with things like how, for example, Robin Williams' death is being handled, even though there's no confirmation of what actually happened, and that there's this drumbeat of, you know, if only there was treatment, and that you don't know that the drugs caused this, the SSRIs, that the withdrawal from the drugs, and none of that's being discussed. We need to talk about it.
I would be interested in finding out what medication he had been on.
In the press conference, they hid behind HIPAA in terms of that, which is fine. I mean, his privacy should be protected. I mean, the fact that he was a public person, a public figure, made this a public event. I mean, this happens every day, and hundreds of people do this every day if this is what was done. But will they ever disclose what drugs, what if there were psychiatric drugs that he was on, is another thing. It's interesting because in the press release, I wish I had recorded it, in the press conference, I could have sworn they specifically said HIPAA, but all the best that I can come up with in the actual press release is the Public Record Act guidelines. But I could have sworn that they named HIPAA specifically as why they weren't giving out information about the medication. But toxicology reports are being conducted, and it said in, I think, 2 to 6 weeks, the testing will,
Right.
Results will be available. So we will see. But it did cause a storm of conversation, and I am very fearful about the way the media will leverage this, and curious as to whether or not Murphy and Tack and all have gotten their hands on this yet, and in what ways, if so, they will spin it.
Well, that was the other thing. They said about 2006, and then, they talk about him coming out of rehab, and then they say 2006, and they go, well, that's not recent. They haven't quite... So you're saying that he had just come out of one earlier this year?
Yeah, I'm not clear. It's my understanding that more recently he went to a rehab type place, but I don't know, and I can't confirm any of that, obviously. But I do think the idea that they're quoting him talking about his quote unquote that they've diagnosed him with depression, whereas everything that I've read, he's never himself actually done that. It's my understanding that they did name HIPAA in the audio of the sheriff's report. I just was told, somebody just texted me. And also this person also just sent me a couple articles dated Friday, August 1st, 2014, California Healthline. This came out in the Daily Digest of News, Policy, and Opinion, californiahealthline.org. It says union says state medical prison facility told employees to falsify mental health crisis unit check-in log. California Association of Psychiatric Technicians says that two managers at the Stockton-based California healthcare facility, the nation's largest medical prison facility, were told to falsify documents saying that they checked in on patients in the mental health crisis unit five or more times per day, even when they were unable to do so. Steve Bassoff, an attorney for the union, said the group contacted the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, but officials haven't responded. So to the whole issue before about falsifying documents and not having clear, so they're just as of August 1st, 2014, further confirmation that people are being instructed to falsify these documents. And so it's not even, the whole idea of a healthcare record and what's going to happen when they go electronic or as they are becoming electronic or, tapped into our little microchips that will be injected into us at some point, I guess.
Right.
And
that's scary.
And how, and how valid they are. So, Raymond, I'm just wondering if you have any final thoughts as we're about to close out.
It gave me food for thought about if I was going to be doing, if I was to ever do a workshop as a peer specialist about what I would be talking about. So, it's interesting how they like you were saying, that they'll throw out HIPAA when it involves them trying to cover up information. When you need to find out what's going on with someone. So, but I'm glad that I was able to call in. Thank you.
Absolutely, and thank you so much. And if you put together that workshop, please let me know. I'd be interested to see what you come to. And thanks for giving us some insight into what's happening, at least in one place, inside of this peer specialist role, and some of the obstacles and challenges that people are facing, and the idea that there are people out there who genuinely want to connect and want to assist others who are coming through and getting out.
That's what keeps me doing my job, really. The bottom line is that I walk away with feeling that I'm actually helping somebody, at the end of the day, that's what makes me want to go come back the next day, so.
And that's a beautiful thing. And for people who, may be listening, who may be struggling, who may be, in that place, to know that there are ways out and that there are people out there who really genuinely want to connect with you, and that it's not about, some quote-unquote diagnosis or quote-unquote treatment plan, but that it's about real, genuine interactions between people who have had shared experiences and who have managed to get out, and that people need to know that we can get out, and that there are ways out. And so thanks again. And tomorrow night we will be on 9 to 11, and Thursday night will be the special with Tina Minkowitz on human rights and the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. I want to thank you, Yvonne and Raymond, for calling in. For everybody who's been listening, and I'm going to ask you all to keep on speaking out. Until next time, talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thanks.
All right, bye.